Zealot by Muslim scholar Reza Aslan is probably the most recent book on the historical Jesus, and I'm going to read his description of the temple in first century Palestine, because the temple sets the stage not only for the crucifixion of Jesus, but because what happened to the temple after his death also influenced how Jesus was seen and remembered both by Jews and the earliest Christians. This story of Jesus and his time is a very big story. And it's fascinating, and it's complicated, and it will take me two Sundays to tell it. The importance of the temple to Jerusalem in the first century to Jews is beyond what we can even imagine. It housed in the innermost court the Holy of Holies, which meant that the temple sanctuary was actually the dwelling place of the glory of God, and it was the meeting point between heaven and earth. The temple was also the center of commerce and the center of Jewish life, because the rituals of the temple marked not just the cycle of the year, but shaped the day-to-day activities of everyone who lived in Jerusalem. It was the largest bank. It housed sacred writings and legal documents, and it was run by a few very wealthy Jewish priestly families whose authority and power came directly from Rome. That Rome was occupying Jerusalem is a key fact to remember. There was only one temple, and this was it. Originally built by King Solomon, but destroyed by the Babylonians in 586 BCE, the temple was rebuilt when the Persians defeated the Babylonians and allowed the Jews to return to Jerusalem. So here's a description of that rebuilt temple. It was rectangular in structure, some 500 meters long, located on top of Mount Moriah. The outer walls were rimmed with covered porticos held up by row after row of glittering white stone columns. On the southern flank is the royal portico, the administrative quarters of the Sanhedrin, the highest judicial court of the Jewish nation. The money changers on the temple's plaza, for a fee, change Roman money into shekels, which was the only currency permitted in the temple. They also collect the temple tax that pays for the incense, the sacrifices, the wine, the first fruit offering, the choir, the orchestra, the lamps, and all the burnt offerings. And with shekels, you can buy a personal sacrifice, a pigeon or a sheep, depending on how much you want to spend and also how great is your sin. Credit is also available. So think of the temple as a kind of feudal state employing thousands of priests and singers and porters and servants, all working on behalf of these few wealthy families who were charged by Rome to maintain it and collect taxes. Aslan says that on feast days, Jerusalem's population would swell to over a million people as pilgrims squeezed through the crush of the crowd and through the temple gates. In summary, the temple was a going concern. It was a holy place, and it was also very much a place that was part of Rome's secular power structure. Two more facts about the temple. The first is that the temple is where Jesus went after his entrance to Jerusalem on what's now called Palm Sunday to confront the money changers, saying, and this is from Mark 11:15, he entered the temple and began to drive out those who sold and those who bought, and he overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold pigeons, and he said, "Is it not written, 'My house is to be called a house of prayer,' but you have made it a den of thieves"? Could he have committed a more radical act? More on this later. The second fact relates to a New York Times article published just this fall claiming that the Temple Mount today is probably the most religiously contested place on earth. 30 years after the death of Jesus, once again the temple was destroyed, and today the remnants of the temple on Mount Moriah are a particularly sacred place for Muslims because they believe Muhammad was taken up to heaven in that very spot. And it's always been a sacred place for Jews, of course, who worship at the one surviving wall, the western wall of the temple. And it's a holy place for Christians, too. Approximately 500,000 a year visit. Today, Mount Moriah is under Muslim control, and there is ongoing controversy and contention about that. And I say all this because it's helpful to remember how many hundreds upon hundreds of years this temple and its location have mattered so much to so many people. It was true 2,000 years ago, and it's true today. In order to really place Jesus in the context of his times, it's also important to have some understanding of the history of Jerusalem leading up to the time of his ministry. Probably the very best of times for ancient Jews were during the rule of kings, especially King David, and then his son Solomon, who built that first temple. As I mentioned, the Babylonians destroyed the temple when they conquered Jerusalem and took the Jews into captivity. But the Persians, who defeated the Babylonians, released the Jews. Many returned to Jerusalem, not all, but those who did rebuilt the temple, which again became the center of Jewish life. Until Jerusalem was conquered yet again, this time by the army of Alexander the Great. And then for the next 200 years, the Greek influence dominated Jerusalem until Antiochus proclaimed himself to be God and outlawed Judaism entirely. This was the outrage that led to the famous revolt of the Maccabees in 164 BCE, which of course is what Hanukkah celebrates. And that victory ushered in a new Jewish sovereignty in Jerusalem for about the next 100 years. But as power is wont to do sometimes, 4 generations later, there was a conflict between 2 ruling brothers, each of whom turned to Rome for support of his position. And Pompey took that opportunity to claim Jerusalem for the Roman Empire, turning the city into a Roman protectorate. And seeking the path of least resistance, as Rome did when it conquered another country, it aligned its interests with the Jewish ruling class, which is how Herod eventually became governor of Jerusalem. He, as we all know, was a particularly brutal governor, massacring Jews and others, including members of his own family and anyone who did not suit his purposes. Aslan says, quote, "Charged with pacifying and administering an unruly and heterogeneous population of at least 24 different sects of Jews, as well as Greeks, Samaritans, Syrians, and Arabs, all of whom hated him more than they hated each other, Herod, despot that he was, did a masterful job of maintaining order on behalf of Rome." So that's the political scene. And if it weren't chaotic enough, first century Palestine was also in the throes of what's called a religious apocalyptic fervor. Jews were waiting and hoping for a Messiah who would come and restore the glory of the days of King David, would free Jerusalem, and would bring back peace, prosperity, and freedom once again. And as a result, it was a time of charismatic figures galore, all willing to either claim they were the Messiah or at least preach that message, and most of them were put to death for doing so. Jerusalem was a dangerous place. First century Palestine was an illiterate world, still steeped in a kind of magical thinking, and it was easy in that world, in that occupied land, to be convicted of treason against the state. That society was highly stratified and depended heavily on everyone knowing his and her place in it. What we know of the middle class simply did not exist. There were the elite, the rulers, priests, and merchants. They made up about 1% of the population. And then there was this great divide, and everyone else was on the other side, the peasants, the artisans, the dispossessed. Jesus was somewhere in the class between the peasants and the dispossessed. Now, think about what he was preaching, what he was saying. He was preaching about the kingdom of God to come. And if you were part of that 1%, you might hear that message for what it really meant, which was a vision of a new and more just ordering of society. Aslan thinks, and I do too, that when Jesus deliberately and publicly challenged the temple authorities by telling the priests they were thieves, he was committing the most radical act of his ministry. But John Dominic Crossan believes the parables that he told were no less revolutionary. Remember the one about the man who was having a dinner, and he asked his servant to go out into the street and invite anyone that he could find to come in and be part of this dinner. The danger of this, says Crossan, was that, quote, the rules of tabling and eating were miniature models for the rules of association, making table fellowship a map of economic discrimination and social hierarchy. To know what, where, when, how, and with whom people ate was to know the character of that society. So Jesus was not just advocating people ignore these rules of association. He was flaunting the rules. Kingdom of God would be a table where everyone could eat. This table was one that fundamentally clashed with the most basic understanding of the accepted norms of the day. He also flaunted the rules of the day, especially the rules of the temple, by healing people who were considered unclean. Judaism at that time had very strict rules about ritual cleanliness. Those who were sick or had skin conditions, lepers, the mentally ill, even menstruating women were all deemed unclean and untouchable, and Jesus touched them all. But what was most subversive about these healings was the fact that Jesus then told the person he had healed that he had cleansed them, and there was no need for them to go and be part of the expensive ritual temple cleansings. So another direct challenge to the temple, another direct challenge to Rome. Today, Crossan says, we look back and we see Jesus' preaching as charmingly iconoclastic. But we have to ask, wouldn't it be just as threatening today? Radical egalitarianism always is. Imagine, for instance, Beacon Hill residents and Pine Street Inn residents, and everyone in West Roxbury, and everyone in Boston. Everyone living here as we do, according to our own means and preferences, but imagine living side by side based on, say, a lottery system. That's essentially what he was advocating. So the challenge of his ministry then, and now too, is a challenge to the most basic level of, quote, civilization's eternal inclination to draw lines, invoke boundaries, establish hierarchies, and maintain discriminations. Come back next week for part 2.